Really pleased to welcome to the program independent candidate for the Norfolk Plymouth Senate District, Alexander Mendez, to chat with us about his campaign, his candidacy, and his platform for the future. Hey, Alex, nice to see you.
Good morning, Joe. Thank you for having me on, as always.
That's our pleasure. Great to talk to you and learn a little bit more about yourself. I thought we should start. I mean, I know who you are. A lot of folks in Quincy do know who you are, but for folks who might not, new people moving into the city and the district all the time, maybe give us a little background about yourself.
All right. Alex Mendez from Quincy. I am a lawyer. My background as a lawyer has involved being a police union lawyer, and it's involved helping indigent people obtain medications and housing and mass health, and homeless people with mental issues like schizophrenia and all that. And this would be my third run for state senate. And check out the website at mendezforsenate.com if you can. We're here to think big, get serious. And that's it. From Marymount.
From Marymount, very good. Talk a little bit about your family if you'd like, or your education background, things like that.
Oh, all right. How about, what would it be? It would be my father's a Chilean immigrant. My mother is from, she's Polish heritage, but was born in England. And we all ended up here in America. I was born and proud of it, as you can tell by the flag. And so then after that, went to Suffolk University. Drug policy was my number one highlight. Trying to use the disparity of how we had the highest prison population in the world and the highest drug overdose rates, all drug focused for a whole bunch of reasons between pharmaceuticals and street drugs and illegal marijuana, pharmaceuticals like the opiates, and how there was a big disparity there. Grew up concerned about that, had friends getting involved in drugs. I used to do drugs. I still do too. No, I'm kidding. And what the heck is it? So then after that, I got a, what would it be called? A bachelor's of art, an undergraduate degree in sociology focused on crime and corrections and government. And then I got a master's degree in public administration, a master's degree in criminal justice studies, all following the same train of thought of studying drug policy. And then I went to law school, Suffolk Law, studied healthcare legislation, all those things. I worked as an intern at the State House. That's where I met John in the first time in my professional capacity. His legislative aide was one of my classmates. Ended up graduating from that law school, and that's it.
So what was it, Alex, that first prompted you to run for this seat back in 2016? And is that the same thing that you're, you know, focused on this time?
Yeah, no, nothing has changed. It's still the kind of bring a fresh perspective, like I said, in 2016, but now it's think big and get serious, because we just need more people involved in local politics, whether it's at the state representation. State rep position in Quincy, we have three state representatives, and I'm not saying they're doing a bad job. I'm saying people, like one of them has been in there for over 30 years, and you're like, well, we need some new people getting involved. I think it'd be good, and challenge makes everyone better. So especially, like I said, the state impact, because people always confuse, well, not confused, but they wonder why I talk about big issues that are so big, whereas they're like, why don't you run for a city position or rep? The scope of answers we need right now need to be so big, and Massachusetts is in a great position to take the forefront on challenges. I mean, we can do scientific applications here of like accelerating renewable energy, but we also have two amazing innovation innovation hubs of Boston and Cambridge between MIT, Harvard, all the startups, all the big companies that are moving in. We actually have the capacity to deal with things on a global level locally. It'd be the same way as Texas being happy that they have oil to run their economy off of. Here in Massachusetts, innovation is one of our largest sectors, which finance is another one, and education. So I say we throw all three of those in a big melting pot, and then we get something good between finance, education, and innovation. We can knock it out of the park and turn that into a great economic boon and provide opportunity for everyone. So to answer your issue of what my goals are. It's to make Massachusetts a leading economy and make us kick butt in that sense. But what we want to do, that takes thinking big and getting serious. We have 40 state senators in Massachusetts and 160 state reps. Everyone needs to kick it up an order of magnitude on how serious they want to talk. Like, we have state reps talking as city councilors, ward councilors talking as like community leaders. Everyone needs to step it up half a step, and that'll make us accelerate the conversation of where we need to be instead of waiting in line, more competition, more ideas. In Massachusetts, a senator's job is to think big and get serious. Like the old word, it derives from a senior senator. It's someone who has longevity in their thought process of how will we be in 30 to 50 years forward. That's what a senator thinks of. They're supposed to be thinking big, all right, and look at the past so how they can guide us towards the future. So I look to the past and I say we invest in science, infrastructure, and people to push us forwards whenever we fall behind. So we're behind right now. So the best way to move forward is by investing in science, infrastructure, and people. A state representative's job is to represent the people's concerns, represent as if that person was standing there to object and give that perspective of the citizen. The senator has to think big and say, I understand this is what you want to do, but what we need as a state is to take these efforts. For example, like the Quabbin Reservoir. I imagine the four towns that got flooded weren't too excited that they had to pick up and leave their whole life, but looking 100 years later, I'm pretty happy that we did those necessary changes. So obviously we need to think big with big projects like that. And one of them would be pretty much right next to the water, how we get our water. We have a big train right next to it, not figuratively speaking, out towards Central Mass. So think big, get serious, and plug the resources that we have here in in the greater Boston area, and we can expand and decongest our state, lower housing rates, lowering costs and living costs, and go from there. So that's why I want to think big as a senator. So I like that idea.
I guess, you know, my question would not be, why wouldn't you run for council or state rep, but why wouldn't you run for Congress or U.S. Senate if you wanted to achieve these long-lasting goals?
Because there needs to be an intermediary. So I think at the state level, between, let's say, Elizabeth Warren and Ed Markey doing the Green New Deal, they need more local voices here to advocate for those things. For example, the high-speed rail would decongest traffic and help lower CO2 emissions, which is a goal parallel to the Green New Deal that Markey has. So if he has a loud voice here in Massachusetts saying, hey, this is something we want, and we have a voice to get inside the Senate and say, hey, this is what we want, this is the direction we want to go, it's going to help facilitate that federal level, especially with people like Lynch. And at the congressional level, they can do their work on a federal level, and it'd be relatively not easy, but if the country were to invest in science, Massachusetts would be a priority, because we have one largest biomedical sector. So there would be a return on investment on what we produce versus if you built a high-speed rail in Wyoming, there's no one there to use it. Here, it would have the greatest return on investment for the nation in helping our economy and helping our local economy here in Massachusetts. So to be a conduit to help the federal level achieve their goals of Green New Deal things, like in transitioning to renewable energies, that would be a great way to apply it here in Massachusetts.
So how would a bullet train to Worcester help, you know, the Norfolk Plymouth Senate district?
Like I said, the goal of the senator is to think big and get serious to help the whole state. That's our responsibility. We have of course, we have to work with local officials. That's bureaucratic things of finding out how much local funding they have here. And it's going to help our district because we need to create jobs and lower the cost of living. This project will create jobs and lower the cost of living. It will create jobs for people involved in STEM industries, so it will make their commute westward easier, or they can move from here out. So that's actually a realistic part. People are moving out of Quincy, out of the district, to go to other areas. So that's, we need to make those other areas in the state better. And it's not just going to help our district, it's going to help the state, it's going to help all of New England. if we do that. That'll increase people being able to live in New Hampshire, in Vermont, in those areas, because we'll facilitate transit. And that'll decongest traffic. And like right now, we have telecommuting. So the issue of traffic, it has to get fixed in so many different ways, not just the MBTA. That's building on a broken system. So where was the original question? I'm sorry, I expanded the frame, but I wanted
to... Yeah, I was just asking how the bullet train, you know, would impact this district. Oh.
And it would cost billions of dollars, but if you divide the cost and divide it by about 50,000, that's as many years of jobs you would have. So let's say like 45 billion divided by 50,000. We have a whole bunch of opportunity to get jobs. That's just a general, it would be a little bit fewer, it'd be like 75,000 a year, the number. So that's just a metric you use. It was used by Jonathan Gruber, who helped write Obamacare. And so what we would do would be using that metric, we'd create so many jobs. If you're a construction worker, if you're an engineer, if you weld, if you work in robotics, if you work in anything, it's going to impact your life of creating jobs. If not in that project directly, it would have peripheral jobs of like, hey, we just injected $20 billion into our state. People have money to spend. So we're going to get restaurants. We're going to build houses. We're going to do all this. So even if you're a waitress, building a bullet train with federal money and local and state and local coordination, it's going to help inject so much money that it helps everyone. So it will make the traffic going to Boston a little bit less, but it will also make the living standard go up. So it's not just about traffic. It's about thinking big and getting serious so that we have the whole economy can build, because then that will lower the cost of operating in Cambridge, but it'll also increase the proximity of our Western state access to that innovation sector. So if you're in Central Mass, you can commute, or you can have your business in Central Mass and still have a regional proximity of 40 minutes, $20 to Boston, which would be fantastic. And it increases proximity. And we also have to increase our resource capacity for housing, for electrical, for water, because in the next year, I hope Massachusetts keeps doing well, which will keep attracting more people from around the world. There's a global trend of having people move to cities like Boston. So we're going to be growing our population at a higher rate. And if we don't prepare, costs will go up and it will have a bad long-term impact. What we need to do is prepare for that growth to make it welcoming for everyone. So that's why as a state senator, we have to think big. Because if we don't prepare, we're going to be caught in a similar situation, not to COVID, but if this was foreseeable, and if we invested in science and infrastructure for medical responses 7-10 years ago, then we would have been prepared. Instead, we had cuts to science, cuts to infrastructure, and increases in our military budget. And that's why we're left so unprepared right now with a disease that we don't know much about. But we should have known about, because it was on our radar. We just didn't invest properly. So what I'm saying is, let's invest properly to prepare for economic growth instead of economic decline.
You mentioned Obamacare. Is that something that you favor, a single payer healthcare system for the nation?
We had in Massachusetts. We could deal with it on a national level. What I'm concerned most about is the health of Americans. Our largest spending is on healthcare, has to do with chronic diseases related to metabolic issues. Breaking that down, we're making ourselves sick because of the food we eat at such a grand scale. It's causing healthcare costs to go through the roof. So that's why I want us to focus on prioritizing health and diet, which will make people's lives longer, healthier. Immune system is something that we have to be talking about right now, because vaccines, that's, we don't know. What we have built in us is a million year old immune system that helps us combat these diseases, which is why we've been here for 250,000 years as humans. So we need to build our immune system with proper diet and exercise and good sleep. And by doing that, we're going to build our immune system, protect ourselves from things like COVID in a responsible way as we advance science, as we should. But it also allows us to reduce healthcare spending because we would reduce rates of obesity, we would reduce rates of diabetes, and those are our highest cost drivers. If you look at healthcare, well over 50% deals with those chronic diseases. So if we can get people to take care of themselves, it will make healthcare spending go down, and we'd actually be more prepared to handle a national paid for, a national healthcare system. So it's on the responsibility of people to take care of themselves, so we're not raising healthcare costs through the roof. For example, to give it those costs would be, I think it's like an extra few thousand dollars every month for someone with diabetes versus someone who doesn't have diabetes. That's diabetes two, the induced by, what is it, diet. So if we have to think big and get serious by not just addressing, yes, we need healthcare for everyone, but we also need people taking care of their own health. And we also have to be cautious of our pill for every ill culture that we're in right now, because I do have so many questions about the pharmaceutical regulations, clinical trials, FDA review processes, the marketing and prescribing. So those are the four issues that we have to be concerned about in pharmaceuticals. So we're not putting unsafe drugs in pushing, because we saw it in opiates and Oxycontin and that, but it happens with almost every other drug we have. I think one in five women is on a psychiatric medication, which is a high number. And as we need to do, what can we do to lower that number to make sure everyone's healthy and not being pushed drugs? And that's why we need to look at it holistically with food, diet, exercise, sleep, make sure our work, working conditions and is stress, not stress-free, but reduce stress by getting rid of things like traffic that are adding 2 hours of traffic onto people's day to make it more stressful, adding anxiety and stress while taking down their money. So we have to improve living quality, improve living conditions. And we do it with things like bullet trains and telling people is something as simple to take care of their own mental health and physical health. And the best way to do that is with diet and exercise and just generally finding positivity and trying to find love in this world. Like not just like personal amoric love, but human love. You know what I mean? Just love of being a human in this world and find happiness. And that's why we need to think big and get serious.
Let's talk a little bit about, some of the racial issues that have cropped up this past year, and particularly the police reform bill is being debated on Beacon Hill, and your feelings about that.
I think it did two things. One, yes, racial injustice is an issue. One of the issues I mentioned, the criminal justice was one of my biggest, I'll put it this way. When I was growing up, freedom was like love for my country, all that stuff, land of the free, home of the brave, bought into it 100%, still buy into it. But when you looked at our history, you saw that there was a disparate treatment of the criminal justice system. And you're like, okay, let's look who's in prison. Black males between the ages of 18 and 30. You're like, okay, something's going on there. Then you look at our history, and then one of the best books that illustrates it is Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. She goes over the transition of the Atlantic trade slave to the slavery to the Jim Crow era, to the civil rights era, to the hard on crime, until our era of mass incarceration now. And what we see is we spend our most money in areas for criminal justice and police in the same areas that never get better, areas like Roxbury, let's say. And we spend so much money in areas that never get better because we're focusing on a militaristic policing view of tough on drugs that it's a resonant of the past, and we're not allocating our money efficiently. So the more money we put in, the more money we're wasting. What we need to do is get to the roots of problems by providing opportunity of education, providing opportunity of good jobs, that things that we can do with free college and a bullet train, which are my two biggest priorities of me, creating hope and preparing us economically for a future. Because I think people just want to be treated equally, which is what I want. This is what we all want. And if you look at a criminal justice system, there are veins of systemic racism. Not so much here in Massachusetts, but yes, here in Massachusetts. When I say not so much, I mean if you look at places such as like Georgia, Louisiana, Texas, and California, those areas have much bigger prison populations than we have here in Massachusetts. But so we need to work on issues of getting to the roots. This isn't individual police officers that we should worry about. Yes, we see highlighted terrible issues of human beings being terrible human beings. And I think our criminal justice system has the capacity to treat criminals as criminals. So if it's a police officer doing wrongdoing, they should be dealt with properly. If it's a regular citizen doing wrongdoing, they should be treated that way. Our criminal justice system provides for that. So we need to have equality before the law. We need to protect our police officers. So we need to keep qualified immunity. But we need to have it so that there's a system that they're not, police officers aren't insulated, that when they do a terrible wrongdoing, that they do face the justice system and they get tried by a jury of their peers and they determine whether it was a criminal aspect or they should be treated as a protected human being, police officer doing their job, which I think that if all cops do their job right, they'll be kicking ass and I got their back. That's what I'm here for. But as I said, I had a background as a police union lawyer doing collective bargaining agreements and grievances. So we need to address it at the roots. We need to protect our cops and protect our citizens. So that's why we need to reform our drug laws, medical models for drug addicts, loosening up, making sure our cannabis laws are all enforced across the country. And what else? Oh, and the police bill. The police bill does nothing. It's only symbolic in nature, I realized. It came so quickly after this issue. It didn't occur. We've had the highest prison populations in the U.S. with the racial disparate vein for decades and decades and decades. That has never gone away. Our politicians in place now have been relatively quiet on that issue from 2010 to 2020 and even the decade before that. So they had almost 20 years to speak up and get loud on these issues, but we didn't. We focused on the opioid epidemic and ignored the racial aspect of our criminal justice system, which is there. And it's not just racial. If you look, whether it ends up being an issue of those with less income, poorer, that's the issue that we're dealing with. The highest statistic for people of drug overdoses are people with the lowest economic, in the people most likely to die of a fatal drug overdose are in areas of lowest economic opportunity, and they're going to be between the ages of like 20 and 40. It's about like a 40-year-old male once their body goes off. But the economic issue is what we're looking at.
So do you think racism should be declared a public health crisis, as some have called for?
No. It's racism is a, what is it? As the critical conflict theorists would say, it's a construct of what we've had in our past. Racism's developed all over all years. If you go to China, they have their levels of racism, but it goes along regional areas, but it also goes with, income, the class systems. That's a thing. So no, I don't think it's a public health issue, but what could be a public health issue is issues like food deserts and higher rates of diabetes due to lack of income, lack of education. And like I said, if they don't have a job or economic opportunity and end up on mass health, they end up with diabetes. We've already invested so much money into that person by taking care of them. Whereas if we invested with education ahead of time, if we invested with a good economy that has jobs and health education, we'd have a human being with a job, education, and no disease. But under our current system, we have people, no jobs, no education, and a disease like diabetes. And that goes off course. So we need to think big and get serious about the issues. And with the police reform bill, it doesn't help groups such as Black Lives Matter because they want to address systemic racism, from my understanding. So that bill does nothing there. For example, some successes that they have are limitations on tear gas use, limitations on chokeholds. Those aren't structural systemic problems. Those are individual problems of dealing with rioting when there's so much relative police brutality and disorder. And then the other one is a tactical maneuver that actually has a good success of anyone that's been in chokehold. If you go online, there are pictures of me choking people, pictures of me getting choked from jujitsu, all that fun stuff. Not that good at it, given the head thing. But so we don't deal with systemic problems. It's chokeholds and tear gas that doesn't deal with the systemic problems. And what we have here on the police end is limitations. I saw how quickly people were turning their backs on police officers. I have friends who are cops. All my friends, their parents are cops, like everything. So I have deep, profound respect for police officers, and I've never met one that's a bad person. Like, I've met some that are bad people, but in the line of their professional duty, I don't think that they would ever hesitate. Is it a white person that's in that burning house? Is it a black person, Chinese? Everyone I know, they wear the backwards flag because that means they're running in to save whose ever life, and that's the America I love. So we can't, then the police officers aren't responsible for systemic racism. So we can't put our anxiety and problems on cops. And I understand the problems of Black Lives Matter, but the responses that they've taken have been so ineffectual because they deal with things of saying, should we not, going against your question, but I'm saying we're focusing, do we declare racism a public health issue, when instead we say, how do we equalize the playing field by creating equalizing opportunity, equalizing education, job access? How do we all participate in our state, in our country, in a positive way? How can we contribute? Because I'm sure if you ask any low-income kid, do you want what the heck is it? Do you want like a substandard, a free substandard life, or do you want to have an opportunity to kick butt and live the American dream and get a job, get an education, and have a return on your community in a beneficial way? I think every kid you talk to wants to give back to their community and help in a positive way. So we need to facilitate the channels to make sure that everyone can contribute in a positive way. And the best way to do that is free education that focuses on STEM, the trades, and lifelong learning, while at the same time taking actionable measures right now to lower the cost of living and create jobs with the bullet train. And that will have big scope issues of reducing CO2 emissions and growing our innovation hub to impact the world.
So how would you pay for free education, Alex, and how much would that cost?
How do we pay for public education? Right now, it comes from taxpayers, so we'd be paying it through taxpayers. What we have to do is eliminate the bureaucratic problems of education, because right now I have $150,000 in debt. So how do we pay for college? I'm paying for college a lot unnecessarily. I'm paying enough college for everyone, and it's about $1,000 in interest. And they've flooded the market with so many useless degrees that there are no jobs. So I feel these issues. I'm speaking from the heart. So what we need to do is increase access. So that's by putting all lectures and content online for free. This isn't anything wild. We have YouTube. We have so many. Sorry about that. I thought I'd turn that off. We have so many good opportunities to get close to people through means such as computers. I'm not a fan of the Zoom meeting for education purposes. I prefer like a lecture model. But if we had over the past 5 years a camera recording every lecture given by a teacher, right now we would have so much content online just accessible through a YouTube database. Do you know what I mean? So you would be paying for within your taxes, if you pay taxes, you get a chip that says you can get all the instant access online you want that's in Massachusetts. So right there, zero cost of it would be not zero cost, but within scope, relatively nothing to have lifelong education for everyone in our state. So that would be people who need to find new jobs if they want to become a nurse while they're working full time as a waitress, they can find that opportunity. So that's It's not how do we pay for it, it's what we get from it. Think of it like that. And we get so much more, which is the fantastic part. And we're already paying through the roof, and it's working backwards, because I think there were 320 people on the Massachusetts Massachusetts State College system who are making over $350,000 a year. So look at that administrative cost. that's so inflated, and it's coming for what? To have a vice president of this, a vice president of that, a vice president of this, a vice president of this, I have assistant to the vice president of blah, blah, blah. And that raises the cost of so much money. We need to cut those administrative costs by accelerating the transfer of information to students, making it more accessible online. And because we're living in an education system that's based on 1,000 years ago, when you had to be in a building with the books, with one teacher who knew the relative small information. Now you can learn so much information from your cell phone, from your tablet, whatever it is, and you can diversify your educational portfolio for the rest of your life and just become a better person. So we gain so much more. So, and we'd cut costs and we'd get so much of a return. Right now, we have so much costs and no return. We have kids with debt. Like my girlfriend and I, we have between the two of us, we have a mortgage and debt, and all we have are a couple pieces of paper. I mean, we're lawyers and it's good that way, but the financial aspect of it, we're financially ruined from trying to improve our lives with education. So I would never wish that upon anyone. So there needs to be a fighter who wants to get rid of student debt in Massachusetts and improve education, because I hate debt, love education. So make it work.
Sounds like you would be in favor of term limits. Would that be true?
No, I think we need people to wake up and pay attention to their, we need the public to pay attention to who's running for office. We need critical analysis of every candidate. And if a candidate's incompetent, we need people to be honest and say that candidate's incompetent. And we need people not just to point out incompetence, we need competent people to serve as replacements and improvements, which I hope I illustrate with John and myself.
So this is your third run at this seat. Are you doing anything differently this time around, Alex, to change the outcome of the election?
It's pretty much just trying to do the flyers. The door knocking, I try to limit the contact with actual people, especially if I'm in going around during the day. I don't want to talk to a family that with kids and then talk to an elderly person. So I've kind of cut the door knocking half. So it's gone the other way, where it had to get reduced, but I've had to adapt my online. I have a lot of fun with that. So we're going to keep that going. And yeah, it's just an interesting component with the door knocking. Cause it's, even when I see people raking, I still kind of take a step. I take a step back, and it's weird, but it's good, and we're gonna get through it. So I look forward to it, and that's something awesome.
Okay. Anything else I'd like to add?
No, I think that's it. Just think big, get serious, and it's time for positive change. And thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate all these.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Good to talk to you, Alex.
Well, fantastic, Joe.
Take care.
Thank you.